Unitarian Universalism is often referred to as a dissenting tradition, having been born in heresy and persecution. As a leading sociologist of religion, Robert Bella told us at our 1998 General Assembly, all American religions have this same genealogy of dissent. As Chesterton once observed, in America, even the Catholics are Protestant. Bella rightly sees this history as inflecting American religions sharply toward individualism rather than communitarianism. He cites polling data showing that 8 in 10 Americans believe that an individual should arrive at his or her own beliefs independent of any churches or synagogues. This may surprise you. Think of all those people reciting the Nicene Creed or some other collective declaration of belief on Sunday morning. But the breadth of the variance between what people publicly profess and what is in their hearts is often great. It would be difficult to overstate the significance of this radical individualism. Like any generalization, of course, it has its degrees of truth and its exceptions. So when I talk this morning about our individualism, and when I try to say something about how we seem to be this way or that about it, these first-person plurals may not be fully descriptive of all Americans or all Unitarian Universalists, and certainly not all Williamsburg Unitarian Universalists. The strong tendency toward individualism, though, is everywhere and affects everyone. Our individualism has political and literary antecedents, too. Like John Stuart Mill, whose extraordinary allergy to community is evident in the quotation in your order of service. Like the attitude depicted in Robert Frost's Mending Wall. And like Walt Whitman's epic individualist poem, Song of Myself, which opens with the line, I celebrate myself, and closes with lines like, I understand God not in the least, nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. I am not a bit tamed. I am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world, said Whitman. For you youths, our individualistic heritage is most dramatically expressed by Ralph Waldo Emerson, Unitarian minister and father of American Transcendentalism. Listen to a few samples from his famous essay entitled Self-Reliance. Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. We won't detour into the glaring archaic irony of the words manhood and every in that sentence. Emerson continues, society is a joint stock company in which the members agree, for the better of securing his bread to each shareholder, to surrender the liberty and culture of the eater. The virtue most in request, says Emerson, is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion. Whenever a mind is simple and receives divine wisdom, he continues, old things pass away. Teachers, texts, temples fall. It lives now and absorbs past and future into the present hour. If, therefore, a man claims to know and speak of God and carries you backward to the phraseology of some old, moldered nation in another country, in another world, believe him not. Nothing at last is sacred, says Emerson, but the integrity of your own mind. When we have new perception, we shall gladly disburden the memory of its hoarded treasures of old rubbish. Pretty individualistic. Emerson's peon individualism I find ironic. His thinking remains in our social DNA today. He is now part of our hoarded treasure, and we don't consider him rubbish at all. In his 1998 General Assembly lecture, Robert Bella demonstrated the ongoing vitality of Emerson's radical individualism among Unitarians quite convincingly, using the abundance of available survey data about our movement. We are undoubtedly the most self-surveyed denomination in the history of religion. Time after time, our answers to such surveys reflect a valorizing of individualism over communitarianism. America's intense individualism, in which many UUs participate enthusiastically, has made many effects on our social and spiritual lives. Among these three strike me as particularly profound. First, individualism affects how we do social justice in both positive and negative ways. We are highly attuned to the unfairness of judging an individual on the basis of non-individual attributes such as race, gender, or sexual orientation. But we tend to see the remedies for such injustices mainly in individualistic terms, such as civil rights legislation. On the whole, we have not cultivated the social skill of using the power of deeper community to heal the wounds and divisions caused by the long historical persistence of those kinds of injustices. Once individual rights have been secured, once the shallower forms of justice making known as tolerance have become the official doctrine, our passion for eradicating racism and other such patterns seems to lose steam. It is almost as if to go more deeply into these ills would require a communal intimacy that poses too much of a threat to our individualism. Once again, Emerson is the pole star example. On the one hand, he passionately eulogized John Brown, the abolitionist insurrectionist. On the other hand, he could say coldly to my ear and without hesitation, "Do not tell me, as a good man did today, of my obligation to put all poor men in good situations. Are they my poor? I tell thee, thou foolish philanthropist, that I grudge the dollar, the dime, the cent I give to such men as do not belong to me and to whom I do not belong." Emerson once called Unitarianism corpse cold. I call that corpse cold. A second profound effect of our individualism is as an incubator of runaway materialism. The sociologist Max Weber demonstrated this over a century ago in his famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Weber and those who taught him showed that modern individualism is a child of the Protestant Reformation. The ascension of individual rights of conscience in matters of religious and political belief led inexorably to a related glorification of the right to pursue one's own economic interests, which included the inviolability of individual property, the freedom of contract, and vocational choice. Protestantism, and specifically Calvinism, was the parent of modern capitalism. Weber saw the exaltations of work and thrift in the writings of Benjamin Franklin and others as an ethically slanted maxim for the conduct of life. This way of conceiving of work saw the generating of material wealth as a religious value. Calvinist capitalism thus could sincerely and consistently glorify the piling up of wealth and yet condemn greed. The asceticism of Calvinism went far beyond abstention from self-indulgence and luxurious living. It was a veritable starvation diet for the soul. Noting the pathos of Calvinism's inhumanity, and particularly its harsh prohibitions against confession or even reliance on ordinary friendship. Weber describes the life of the Calvinist entrepreneur as one of tremendous inner loneliness. Given these conditions, it should not be surprising that the piling up of material wealth as a form of glory to God eventually devolved into addictive materialist grandiosity. As Weber pointedly observed, where capitalism is at its most unbridled, in the United States, the pursuit of wealth, divested of its metaphysical significance, today tends to be associated with purely elemental passions, which at times virtually turn it into a sporting contest. It has only gotten worse since 1905, when Max Weber wrote those words. What would poor Max think today? For those of us in modern liberal religion who consider ourselves critics of the excesses of global capitalism, this is an embarrassing piece of social archaeology. The embarrassment is magnified by the ratification of Weber's analysis by contemporary liberal sociologists like our good friend Robert Bella, who declared to us in his 1998 General Assembly lecture, "Freedom of conscience and freedom of enterprise are more closely, even genealogically, linked than many of us would like to believe." Our relationships with social justice and materialism seem to me to be closely connected to a third profound effect of our radical individualism. To a great extent, we do church essentially as a loose confederation of individuals. The voice of truth is personal and is heard as speaking in the first person singular. Emerson's declaration that nothing is sacred but the integrity of each individual's own mind is very much with us. Whitman's rhapsodic description of himself, and thus of each of us, as untamed and untranslatable, would seem to leave very little universal truth about the human condition to be pursued through communal worship. Little point in the comparison of notes about our shared spiritual predicaments, or collective study, or spiritual practice. In short, all of the things that make church, church. Sometimes it almost seems as though the main universal truth we recognize is the universality of our intense and unalloyed individualism. Now, I actually see WUU as rowing against this current, and I am hopeful it will row that way ever more resolutely. But the cultural current is very strong. I think of religious seekers as people looking for answers to questions about the spiritual aspects of the human condition. These questions assume a universal element in human life that makes individual experiences translatable, comparable, amenable to fruitful discussion. To say, as do radical individualists, that each individual's mind is the final arbiter of such questions is essentially to deny this universal element and to treat religious experience as purely personal. If you have any doubt about whether Unitarian Universalism is still enthralled with the radical individualism of Emerson, take a look at the UUA's recent Time magazine ads. One of them describes UU congregations as places, quote, "where no one's idea of God is better than another's," end quote. The phrasing reminds me of the old story about the Jeffersonian farmer whose son was heading off to the city, and the farmer said to his son, "Remember, my son, you're as good as any man, and no better." The ad text has a nice ring to it, a kind of equal dignity for everyone's religious convictions. But the ad is not about the legal right of free exercise of religion, so something no one can seriously dispute. Rather, the ad is saying that without knowing anything about the particular religious ideas or answers entertained by any given group of people in any given UU church on any given Sunday, we can with confidence pronounce them all to be of equal value. Now, if these ideas and answers were addressing a question about something universal in human experience, then mightn't some of them be better than others in capturing that universal something, helping us all to understand it better? Unlike people, all ideas are not created equal. And as to this kind of universal question, if I really thought no one at a church had any ideas or answers that could possibly be any better than the ones I myself had already come up with, I can't imagine why I would go. The point of going, after all, would be to improve upon my own best thinking, which, in all humility, has not yet caused a life of perfect fulfillment to unfold in front of me. I would entertain some hope that at least the minister would be able to offer some such improvement. And if he didn't, I surely wouldn't join the congregants there in paying him the fancy sums you generous and discerning people pay me to preach, just to have him tell me things no better than what I already know. Do you see the meaning sitting underneath the ad? It is that religious experience is, in fact, purely personal. Really is a matter of individual taste, rather than a quest for truths of universal relevance. It is the reduction of God to an ice cream flavor. If the American Cancer Society ran an ad declaring, "We are committed to the principle that no one's ideas about curing cancer are better than anyone else's," would that make you want to contribute money? You may say that's different because curing cancer is a matter of science, and religion certainly isn't a matter of science. Indeed. But religion is still a pursuit of knowledge and wisdom and healing, and a far cry from a matter of personal taste, like chocolate or vanilla or strawberry. So the ways in which our individualism affects how we relate to social justice, to materialism, and to church are of great importance. But sitting beneath these, there is an effect even more profound. Our individualism is our lived declaration of what is permanent versus what is transient, natural versus fabricated, primary versus secondary. We tend to see our individual presences in community more as a matter of social contract than organic development. Thus, it is not surprising that Emerson would describe community as a kind of joint stock company. To him, community certainly would not be the context for creating or shaping human identity. It would be more like a marketplace to be visited from time to time for the purposes of mutually advantageous but arm's length exchange. Our radical individualism represents our view of reality with a capital R. It is that fundamental. From time to time, we therefore must ask ourselves whether this reality view is a valid rendering of our human condition, or instead is a damaging distortion. Now, it's very difficult to find anyone who's against community. I don't know anyone like that. We often talk about building it with all of the sentimentality that the building metaphor seems to bring on. Underneath all of this Hallmark greeting card rhetoric lies an assumption that community is like any other possession. And if we don't have it, We'd better build it or get it. But what sociologists and theologians have been trying to tell us for quite a while is that community has us as much as we have it. Without community, there is no us. Just as without water, there are no fish. The only open question is, what's the water quality? Does our community nurture us, heal us, foster the nobility and individual creativity in each of us? Or does it isolate us, damage us, and pull us down from our nobility? Or some combination of those two effects? In America and in Unitarian Universalism, we have a community. It's just that, if you'll permit the oxymoron, it's a radically individualistic community that seriously limits how deep we can go in human relating. And this form of community is profoundly shaping the life of every individual in it, as community always does. Among political and religious leaders out in the field, so to speak, I know of no one who understood the power of community to shape individual identity better than Malcolm X. He saw integration as a toxic environment for African Americans who had been damaged in their sense of self-worth by centuries of chattel slavery and racial vilification. As James Cone, a leading African American theologian, has observed, if blacks were going to achieve the unity necessary for the attainment of their freedom, then self-hate, according to Malcolm, the number one problem in the black community, had to be replaced with a love of themselves. In Malcolm's perspective, black people should not even think about uniting with or loving any other people until they first learn how to come together with love and respect for each other. Malcolm knew that no individual can generate self-love and self-esteem in isolation, particularly against a long history of social, political, and cultural hostility to that self-esteem. His objective was nothing less than the decolonization of the black mind, so as to transform his people into proud black African people. He surely was about that work when he gave a speech about black identity at the Cornhill Methodist Church in Rochester, New York, on February 16, 1965. Because whites were so successful in projecting a negative image of Africa, he said, those of us here in the West of African ancestry, we looked upon Africa as a hateful place. We looked upon the African as a hateful person. And what was the result? Whites ended up with 22 million black people here in America who hated everything about us that was African. We hated the African characteristics. When you teach a man to hate his lips, the lips God gave him, the shape of the nose that God gave him, the texture of the hair that God gave him, the color of the skin that God gave him, you've committed the worst crime that a race of people can commit. And he said to white people, this is the crime that you have committed. 5 days later, speaking at the Audubon Ballroom in New York City, Malcolm was gunned down by a team of assassins. Next Thursday is the 43rd anniversary of his untimely death, largely unmarked in the pantheon of American holidays. The wisdom he found concerning the relationship between community and individual identity remains highly relevant today, as we ask whether the way we conceive of our religious community can be made to serve our best aspirations better. Robert Bella was reflecting that wisdom 10 years ago when he told us at General Assembly that American radical individualism is a mistake with enormous cultural consequences. Only by embracing a more social understanding of human nature, he concluded, can we divert American culture from the destructive course upon which it seems to be set. for our part in it as Unitarian Universalists. Bella suggested that such a social understanding would mean making the interdependent web of all existence our first principle instead of our last one. I am all for it. And even as I say that, I feel America's radical individualism in my very bones. I am a wild duck who has trouble flying in formation. Even in a flock as loosely connected as the UUA. To believe in the value of community does not make one temperamentally a communitarian universalist. It will be hard work, but it is the work. It is the spiritual growth for which in our hearts, all of us and each of us long, every last duck.